right, I'd like to call this meeting of the Post Council today in order. We have some excused members today, Colonel Fuhrer, Mr. Gibson, and Dean Dillingham Evans. With that, I'd like to welcome everybody to this meeting, and the first matter of business will be approval of a March 28th meeting minutes. It's going to be one of those days. So, okay. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
All right, next we're going to have our attorney from the Attorney General's Office, Mr. Bolander, provide us some training on HIPAA and the post statute. Kevin, you ready?
Are we doing that or is it the open meetings?
Well, it's the open meeting training, and those are two subsections of it.
After it. Oh, they are? Oh, okay. Well, do it all.
Okay.
All right, good morning, Council. As you know, every year each administrative body has to do their annual open and Public Meetings Act training. And so that's what we're going to do. So I'm going to be spending a few minutes, and there's a lot of little details. And so my focus is going to be on just sort of highlighting kind of general issues, and those, you know, that might be more relevant to this council. And so it's not going to answer like every single little aspect of open meetings, but it's enough to just kind of give us ideas of what we should be looking for and things we should be aware of while we are in meetings. So I've sent out a handout around, which just has just kind of like a summary. You can follow along. So the way I kind of look at the Open and Public Meetings Act is I kind of divide it into kind of three areas. And the first is essentially stuff that needs to happen before the meeting. And that's essentially kind of the notice requirements. And then the next is issues in the actual meeting itself. And those primarily focus on when can a council or board close a meeting. And then finally, what needs to happen afterwards. And that's basically the posting of minutes and the recording of the meeting. So the broad point of the Open and Meetings Act is that, well, it's called open meetings for a reason, which is essentially the meetings are open with a few exceptions, and that public officials make decisions on policy and things like that in open, you know, so the public can come in and see what's going on. Now, a public body, and just to make sure what we're talking about, public body is basically any state advisory or legislative body that has two or more people, spends either tax money or supported by tax money, and has authority to make decisions about the public's business. And so that basically includes, that's pretty broad. And so that includes a lot of things, including this council. I will point out that executive sessions and workshops are generally included as part of in the definition of a public body. And yeah, so with meetings, and just to make sure what we're talking about too, what constitutes a meeting, that's anything with a quorum. So a simple majority shows up, that's a meeting. And the other aspect of that is discussing an act or matter that's under its authority. And so what you'll notice is things like chance meetings or social gatherings aren't considered meetings. But if a majority of you show up to discuss issues that are relevant to this council, then yes, that's a meeting. I do want to mention quickly about electronic meetings, like appearing, like say you want to appear, have somebody appear, you know, by telephone or phone bridge or Skype or whatever. It is allowed. You do need a rule. it does need to be in the council's rule to allow that. I'm not sure. I don't think this council currently has that. We're actually right now looking at maybe making a rule that's applicable to the entire department of public safety that would allow members to participate by a phone bridge or Skype or whatever. So I'll keep you updated on that. So I kind of want to jump into notice. And this is kind of going back to what I was talking about, like stuff that needs to happen before the meeting. And here are the requirements. And fortunately, this council's been pretty, and Sean has been pretty good at, you know, meeting these, and so we don't have a lot of issues. But just as a reminder, notice, you need 24 hours minimum notice before a meeting. And you need written notice either at the building that the meeting is going to be held at or at the principal office of the public body. In addition to sort of the written notice, you need to place notice on the Utah Public Notice website. You also have a requirement to give notice to like a newspaper of general circulation, but from what I understand, this is covered. If we are posting on the public notice website, that does take care of the notice to the media as well. And then in addition to that, we have to give notice of the tentative schedule of the council and when they plan to meet. Now, just talking about emergency meetings, these are meetings where some unforeseen comes up, and it's an emergency or an urgent matter. And basically, what the law says about this is essentially the council has to do its best to comply with the requirements, but it's not held strictly to the requirements in the Open and Public Meetings Act. One thing to keep in mind, though, if there is an emergency meeting, make sure that you put the reason why you had to have the emergency meeting in the minutes. And then keep in mind, notice also includes not just like the time and place of the meeting, but also includes the agenda. And the reason the agenda is important is because unless something's on the agenda, the council can't take final action on it. Now, there is one, it's not really an exception, but the council can talk about things not on the agenda if it's like brought up by the public. You notice sometimes when you go to like a board meeting or something, they say, does anybody in the public have, anybody in attendance have something they'd like to bring up? And that's fine to discuss, but again, can't take final action because it needs to be in the agenda prior to the meeting. Yes. If something is not on the agenda that is brought up by somebody in attendance, you can. Now, agenda items, I would say yes, the council could, but again, it's going back to not taking action. You can't take action. Although I would not recommend talking about discussing something not on the agenda. Probably best just kind of stay clear from that. So next I want to talk about like the actual meeting itself. And the big topic here is when you can close a meeting. And as we all know, meetings are to stay open with the exception of a few circumstances, and those are listed in statute. Probably the one that's most relevant to this council is a provision that allows a discussion of character, professional competence, physical or mental health of an individual. That one I think is relevant. There's other reasons you can close a meeting. A lot of them aren't really applicable to this council, but some of the other ones, discussion of regarding security personnel devices and systems. I mean, again, probably not relevant to this council, but maybe investigative proceedings regarding allegation of criminal misconduct. And then one that's kind of an interesting one is a deliberation of adjudicative body. Now, that provision isn't in the statute, but there's court cases that support that if you're doing deliberations. You can go into closed session, but you can't do fact-finding, and you can't make a decision. You still have to vote in public. So those are the reasons. So there's not a lot. Now, how you close the meeting is you need 2/3 vote from the council, and you have to start in public. You have to start the meeting in public and then go into closed session. So you just can't start right into a closed session. You can't have like a meeting that's exclusively like a closed meeting. So you have to at least start as a public meeting. And then the reason for closure needs to be put into the minutes. Now, if this council is in closed session, there are some limitations, and some of them are obvious. Like, you can't approve, like, a rule or resolution or take final action on a matter. Your vote has to be in open session. And then this one, and then the next kind of main limitation to be looking for is the closed meeting is only limited to the topic for which the meeting was closed. Now, I don't think a lot of us, like, intentionally close a meeting so we can talk about something else. But in my experience, I've seen sometimes the conversation will just sort of creep into other topics. And so that's just something to kind of be aware of. And just, you know, if the conversation is starting to veer into different issues, then it's time to go back into open meeting. So keep it narrow. Now, the closed part of the meeting is classified as protected under GRAMA. And so obviously those minutes and the recording obviously will not be available to the public. So they're classified as protected. The only exception is if we get a court order that compels us to disclose it. There is one exception. So that's one thing to know is generally the general rule is when you're in closed session, you do need to keep a recording of the minutes and a recording of the meeting and keep minutes. There are two exceptions though, where you don't need to do this, and this is if you're talking about the character or the competency or like the health of an individual. That one you do not need to keep minutes and recording for. However, you do need an affidavit from the chairperson saying that this is what we talked about. So basically the affidavit just kind of substitutes for those minutes. Then the other exception is for talking about like security and personnel and security systems and things like that. So kind of the last part I want to hit on is the recording of the minutes, because it's sort of the what I kind of deem as the stuff you do after the meeting. And again, generally this council's been in pretty good shape with that, and so that's good news. So the minutes basically includes the whole meeting, which includes a recording and the written minutes. And again, with the exception of those things that are in closed session. Now, those are classified as public records, again, with the exception of anything that's been done in closed meeting. Those are public records. The content that needs to be in the minutes, date, time, and place of the meeting, names of all members, council members that were present and absent, so we make accounting for everyone who's on the council, all matters proposed, discussed, or decided, the individual votes on all the matters, and the name and substance of information given by people attending after recognition by the chairperson. Essentially, I mean, if somebody who's attending gets up, you know, have them give their name, and then, you know, record what they had to say. Now, this part is new. The statute was amended this year as far as they put some more specific time limits on when things are supposed to be available to the public. And so minutes have to be posted before approval at the next meeting. Now, here are the new time frames. We have 30 days to post pending minutes. We have 3 days to post approved minutes and 3 days to post the audio or a link to the audio recording after a meeting. And then in addition, each public body must have procedures to approve the minutes of each meeting, which we have, so we're good there. And then the minutes, once approved, become the official record. So, you know, nothing you didn't already know, but Just the very last thing about open meetings, and this fortunately has not been an issue yet, but if there's violations of the act, kind of the consequence is a court can come in and void any action taken in violation of the Open Meetings Act. Sometimes, and one thing to keep in mind with this is, as an incentive to comply with the law, is sometimes an agency can potentially be on the hook for attorney's fees and things like that if they are in violation of the law and get called on it and lose. That is, a state agency can be on the hook for the attorney's fees for that. And then just finally, and I hope it never comes to this, but there is potential criminal violations if we knowingly or intentionally violate the law, or knowingly, intentionally, or advises a violation of the closed meeting provision. So, and this is different than if we legitimately think we have a good reason to go into closed session, but if we know we don't have a reason and we do it anyway, that's a criminal act. So let's not do that. Okay, so that's all I have on open meetings, unless there's any questions.
Okay, do you want to go into HIPAA and the post statute, sir?
Yes. Actually, let me grab my statute book. Now, if you recall, I was asked to kind of research some issues on the council, and this was in context of as you're deliberating with officers and dispatchers that come before you with potential sanctions, sort of what room essentially you have to ask questions and get information to help you make your decision. Specifically, you know, we asked, specifically one of them was about HIPAA, and so I will address that. So as I did this research, I think what was helpful to me was sort of to keep it in context of what the council is doing. And basically, what the council is doing is you're essentially deciding where to turn the sanction dial. And you have a wide range, ranging from essentially nothing to a full revocation. And so that's what you do, is you essentially decide where are we going to turn that sanction dial for each person that comes before us. And so in that sense, these disciplinary sanctions proceedings are pretty narrow. I mean, if you read what the statute says in 53.6.211, and this is, you know, something that's come before the council shall review the findings of fact and conclusion of law and the information concerning the peace officer provided by the officer's employing agency and determine whether to suspend or revoke the officer's certification. So in a sense, it's pretty narrow. And at this point, the fact-finding essentially has been done. That's what happened at either an ALJ hearing or through a hearing waiver or through a default order. And so that part's been done. You're just deciding, again, just what is the appropriate sanction based on the information presented to us. And so you're kind of looking at the circumstances of the fact to kind of determine that. So there's an issue. So last meeting there was a question about the applicability of HIPAA laws. And I researched that, and the short answer is this. I don't think HIPAA applies to this council. HIPAA, because it's not what's called a covered entity. And HIPAA defines covered entities basically as healthcare providers, you know, health insurance companies, things like that, and you're not one of those, and so in that sense, HIPAA doesn't apply. However, I think there's other issues though regarding the discussion of health information. So it's not from my aspect, it's not really so much a HIPAA issue as it is discussing health information in an open meeting, if that makes sense. And the other part too is not just discussing some, you know, potentially private information, open meeting, but maybe its relevancy to the hearing. Again, you're just deciding the appropriate sanction. And so this kind of goes into another issue is what materials, you know, can the council use to, you know, make its determination. And again, I just read you the statute, and what the statute says is basically you get the findings of fact and conclusions of law that were kind of done at the lower level. That usually, and what I think what we've done up until now is, and again, plus including whatever information provided by the employing agency, I think what that's included was what we've provided so far has been the pleadings and the notice. I think is what we've typically provided. So as far as being entitled to additional information beyond that, like say maybe the post-investigative file, my recommendation is I'm a little hesitant to recommend that you see those. And the primary reason is I'm still researching this, but I'm a little bit worried about the potential litigation liability. If you start using documents beyond the findings of fact, and you know beyond the order from the ALJ or the default order or whatever, I'm worried about the potential liability if that decision gets appealed from the post council, because now you're using records like kind of beyond the record that you received. And so I'm in the process of talking to some of the appellate attorneys at the AG's office to kind of get a feel for what we can provide. But in the meantime, I kind of recommend not using those because of that issue.
Kevin, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Because I think it becomes a little muddy. I think that's very clear. But then when you put an officer or their attorney up to represent what's in that file and they start to testify before this board about what may or may not be in that file and relevant information, that starts to take a different twist, because I think then that becomes relevant information that may have started in open meeting.
Right.
And might be appropriate. You know, we can certainly deliberate in private on that, but that changes it when that. Otherwise, if it's a nice little thing and no one stands up to testify before us, but once they do, it does change the nature of it.
And you're exactly right. And I think the difference that you pointed out is if somebody stands up here to give, and they're allowed, someone's, you know, is allowed to stand up here and give their mitigating, you know, give their argument for a more mitigating sentence. The difference is they open that door, as opposed to post counsel opening that door. I think that's the big distinction. So if somebody wants to come up here and give evidence, like say, oh well, I, you know, like went to rehab or something like that, they've brought that up. They've brought that up, and then you can take that evidence into consideration, and you can decide how much weight you're going to give whatever mitigating facts they've given to the matter. Does that make sense?
No, it does make sense, and that's kind of where we wandered into it, because the young man who stood up there and started to talk about his, you know, situation certainly led us down the road that you got to ask those questions if he's going to use that as mitigating or potentially aggravating circumstances in this case.
Right, and I think that kind of gets to exactly kind of the issue, like what are the appropriate questions, especially if someone's like bringing up information that they are hoping will help kind of mitigate their sanction. And again, I don't think there's like a straight up clear line answer to that. I think it's fine. I think it's in the obviously fine category. I think it's asked to ask clarifying questions about that. And that's kind of more directed to getting an understanding of the circumstances again. I think maybe the advice I give the council is with questions we ask, it's more about how relevant is it to the conduct at issues. Does it help us determine, does this question help us determine like how much weight we give to mitigating facts? Does it help us give context to the facts that are before you? So again, it's not fact finding. It's just kind of getting an understanding of them and clarifying. Yes?
Along that same line, my question would be, if the individual brings a document, let's say some medical records, he wants to submit them, does the deliberation on that that we then end up taking for a discussion on what weight to give it, should that move to the closed session and then come back out of the closed session, or do we do that in the open? That's kind of my biggest concern.
I think it really depends on the document. And what's interesting, if they're the ones bringing it, if you have an officer bringing it in, it kind of changes it too, because our concern as a government entity is we don't want to be disclosing things that may be classified as like private or protected. Now, if that person who's like the subject of the record comes in with it and kind of voluntarily discloses that, I mean, that does change the scenario a little bit.
I accept that, and I understand that, but I guess then it is as a council that we start to deliberate the weight of that, or to amongst ourselves, should that move into the closed session under, you know, the personnel part of a closed session, or do we just go ahead and deliberate and ask those questions and make the statements about weight in the open public part of that? That's my question.
And again, I don't think there's like a straight yes or no answer. I think it is going to be kind of fact specific. I think if you're discussing sort of like the mental fitness of somebody, I'd probably recommend that would be moved into closed session. If you're discussing the weight to say, like, he comes in and says, well, I went to rehab or something, and as a mitigating, that might be one where maybe you talk about the weight you give it in public. I mean, but again, it's just kind of fact specific, so there's not an easy answer there.
So in other words, Mr. Bolander, as long as we don't ask more in-depth questions about what the rehab consisted, how long he was in it, who the provider was, did he successfully complete it, is that what you're saying?
Yes, I think, again, it goes back to how relevant it is to the actual count that comes before you, or the conduct.
Okay, well, let's say it's a DUI, an alcohol-related offense. So he brings in, or she brings in, through their testimony to the council, that they've completed rehab. So how specific can we get about what did that rehab consist? I think that's the question we're trying to get at, is should we then move into open or closed session to ask those specific questions?
I would say it kind of depends how much information they give you. If they get up and say,
but we're not going to know that.
Yeah, I went to rehab.
Right.
I mean, it's probably appropriate to be, if someone asks, okay, like, and, you know, like, I think it's fine to get some clarifying questions. I think where we run into trouble is if we continue down a line of questioning and it kind of gets beyond helping us determine what weight we give it, if that makes sense. Because sometimes we're trying to gather maybe more facts we necessarily need. So again, I think if it's kind of more along the lines of clarifying, I mean, I don't know, and again, I mean, it's kind of hard to say, like, how much detail are you going to need about, like, this rehab thing. But, I mean, because the question is not so much about the rehab, it's about what weight do you assign it? Does that make a difference based on the DUI conviction they got or their conduct they did? Does that make a difference on whether you're going to adjust their sanction or not? And that's kind of the question. And I think what I'm getting at is that's kind of the overarching question you need to keep in mind.
Okay. Then I think what the council will need to do is rely on your expertise in the legal system to advise us when our line of questioning perhaps approaches that threshold that it may be wise now to move into closed session.
Right. And I'll do the best I can. And again, it's a tricky thing because there aren't bright lines. Like,
right, but you're the lawyer, we're not.
Yes,
so
that's what I'm paid to do, okay. I guess. So I will.
Okay.
That is what I will do. And so, again, yeah, it just goes back to determining whether the facts of the matter support suspension or revocation. And so that's where I kind of leave it at this point. I do want to mention just while we're talking about the statute and kind of the board, the council's scope, just if I could make mention of recusals. If a council member is going to recuse themselves, I recommend they do it right at the beginning of the matter. Because it's the recusal is more than just the voting. It's the discussion, too, because the discussion could potentially maybe sway other board members. And so I'd recommend that recusals be done, like, right at the beginning. So if a matter comes up and hear the name, like, that member just says, I'm going to recuse myself from this. And
then not participate in the discussion at
all. Yeah, I don't – the way I read it is not – that's probably the right way to go, because even if they're participating, like I said, they could still – influence other council members to think or vote a certain way.
Well, typically the reason to recuse would be that the most common reason we see is that that person's one of our own employees. And if that's the case, then, you know, if the council member can't speak, then we put the employee and the agency, I think, in the undesirable position of having the chief executive of that agency not speak. So I'm not sure that I would agree with that. Council member couldn't speak. I think if you disclose and recuse, I don't think that strips the agency executive of the ability to present to the council. And I don't think we should disband our sheriffs and chiefs that way.
No, and I agree with that, but there's a difference between discussion as a council and the person speaking.
Fair enough.
Speaking in their capacity as like the chief of that agency. So I mean, I agree. As long as that distinction's made, then we should be good. So,
okay. Any questions on those, the HIPAA or the post statute? Don't leave, Mr. Bolander. I'm going to put you on the spot one more time. Down at the bottom of the pack or the agenda, we have discussion on disciplinary packets. As you may recall, in last meeting, there was some discussion about council considering asking for the complete investigative file on these matters before they come to us so they can be reviewed by a council before we get to these meetings, because at times some members of the council have questions of the investigators that
right.
They're having to refer to their report, and it would be much easier, it was discussed, that we might be able to read this material ourselves. What's your take on that?
I'm a little hesitant to provide it, right? At least right now. I'm looking into a couple of issues. Again, it goes back. The primary issue I'd be concerned about providing that material is just in case one of your decisions is appealed to the Court of Appeals, and you have the record you're using, which is essentially this meeting plus, you know, whatever materials is usually the findings of fact or the or, you know, the order from the ALJ or the hearing waiver, which in the notice and then the responsive pleadings to that. If you're using documents beyond that and including that in, I don't have the answer yet, but I'm a little bit worried about what that could mean potentially if something goes on an appeal. If you're adding things into your record that. If you're using things that aren't in the record to make a decision, if that makes sense?
Well, no, because everything that we review here is predicated upon those investigative reports prepared by staff and then presented in summary to us.
Right, and that would be the notice, and then from that the order.
Okay, unless there's disagreement, why don't we move this to our next meeting and allow you to finish your research on this?
I can do that, yes. I'd be happy to.
Just one quick question. If it goes up on appeal, is the process that's going up on appeal, or is it the facts? It's the process, is it not?
Well, the facts, well, here's the problem is, yeah, well, the problem is the Court of Appeals doesn't do fact-finding. It just takes essentially the facts that were made by this council and in the ALJ hearing. If there was one. And so that's the concern, is it kind of leaves a little bit of an issue, is if there's something like, say, the investigative report that the council reads beforehand with information. I that's what I'm looking into, is if there's an issue where somebody on appeal can say, well, council members were looking at the investigative report and that wasn't in the record, and that's what I'm worried about. And so I need to talk to some of the appellate attorneys and see if that's an issue or not. Then there's the other kind of maybe a little bit more minor issue is we typically classify the investigative reports as private. And so now we have a private, and there's going to be kind of disclosure issues with something that we typically do not disseminate. And so give me a little bit more time to sort through that.
Just one comment on that, because we have the same thing when we had talk about internal affairs investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are private, and you can classify them as such and protect them underground. But once the employee appeals that to a public body, which is the Court of Appeals or anything else, then they themselves are the ones that are making those open to the public. And so I may disagree with you a little on that and think that that's part of the process that comes along with appealing.
It's a fair point.
Any more questions for Mr. Bolander? Okay, we'll look forward to your final report on this matter next meeting, Mr. Bolander. Thank you. We'll move now to Director Stevenson presenting the disciplinary cases. And Chief Burbank has to be excused. He has another commitment.
Thank you, Chair, Council. First case on the docket is Michael A. Wall, formerly with Tooele County Sheriff's Office. The offense category is C, assault, DV, and DV in the presence of a child, and criminal mischief. Recommending 3.5 years, 3.5 years suspension, and this is under order of default. I'll provide a summary. On November 18, 2011, criminal charges were filed against Michael A. Wall, a correctional officer with the Tooele County Sheriff's Office, for domestic violence assault. According to statements obtained from Wall and his wife, Wall assaulted his wife on three separate documented occasions. On the first occasion, he forcefully took her cell phone by bending her arm behind her back and causing injury to her shoulder. He then grabbed his wife by the shoulder and pushed her out the door of their home. On the second occasion, he grabbed his wife by the shoulders, placed his hand around her throat, and punched a hole in the wall next to her head. On the third occasion, in the presence of his infant child, he grabbed his wife by the arm, shoved her down onto the sofa, and then punched the sofa next to her head. On all three occasions, Ms. Wall sustained some form of injury, including bruising on her arm and shoulder.
Okay. Is Mr. Wall or counsel for Mr. Wall present today? Okay, we'll bring it back to counsel.
Move to accept the recommendation from POST.
Second.
Motion and second. Any questions, comments on the motion?
I have a question. And this is just because I'm new to the council, I'm not sure. In a case where you've got an enhanceable crime, is that considered at all?
I only heard of in case of a crime.
If the crime itself is an enhanceable crime and we've got multiple incidents, is that taken into consideration or is it just
it is by the post staff. Counselor, and take that into consideration as mitigating or extenuating circumstances as well. Any other questions or discussion? Okay, we'll have a motion and second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Director Stevens.
Next case involves Justin C. Matson, formerly with Cache County Sheriff's Office. Offense category is B, sexual conduct while on duty, recommending a 3-year suspension. An ALJ hearing was conducted. Terminated 10/24 of 2011. In the fall of 2011, Justin C. Matson, a deputy with the County Sheriff's Office, was involved in a sexual relationship with an area dispatcher. Sometime in September of 2011, Matson and the dispatcher engaged in sexual intercourse behind an industrial complex in Smithfield, Utah. Matson had driven his patrol vehicle to the rendezvous and was wearing his duty uniform.
Okay. Mr. Madsen or a representative from Mr. Madsen here? Okay. Sir, would you step up to the podium and provide your name?
Could be okay if the chair would, Mr. Madsen would like to address the council briefly.
Yes, sir.
Do so as well.
That's,
thank you.
That's appropriate. Sir, please state your name for the record.
Justin C. Madsen, M-A-T-T-S-O-N. I'd like to thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak today. I do apologize for my actions. I have apologized personally to Sheriff Nelson about what took place. I'd like to thank Post on the investigation that they were able to do. I was unaware of what could take place, not only to my career, as to my family. It's very hard to have an 8-year-old ask why you're not a cop no more, and have to explain that. Also, for secondary employment, I work at Cache Valley Hospital as a security guard, and have had many run-ins with fellow deputies and fellow officers. During those times, I have had many chances to think about what I did and what it's going to take to get back to where I was. I do take responsibility for my actions and what occurred, and I would just again like to thank you for giving us the time to speak in front of you.
Very good, Mr. Madsen. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, counsel. My name is Dustin Erickson. I'm representing Mr. Madsen. I have just briefly, and I apologize to the council because many of you may already have these in front of you, but I've got a couple of handouts, if I may.
Okay, Mr. Erickson, you'll be provided 20 minutes for your presentation.
I appreciate that. We'll be significantly shorter than
all
that.
Right,
thank you. What's being passed out to the council right now is actually a copy of the code, the Utah code, which Mr. Madsen violated, the misconduct that he engaged in. And then also there's a highlighted section from the Utah administrative rules, specifically a rule concerning Garrity. Mr. Madsen made an error in judgment. He stood before you and acknowledged that, and throughout the process has been very forthright and honest with not only the Cache County internal affairs investigation, but also with the Post investigation. And nobody is here denying the error in judgment that he made. However, there are a few mitigating circumstances that I'd like to bring up to the council, and would hope that you would consider those in making your final decision on sanction. First and foremost, there were some Garrity situations that took place in the investigation, specifically in the internal affairs investigation at Cache County. The IA officer there, it was his first time conducting an internal affairs investigation. And I think likely because of that, he failed to advise Mr. Madsen of his Garrity rights. It was from that interview with the IA officer at Cache County that the conduct that Mr. Madsen engaged in was discovered. And if you look at that administrative rule 728-409-5 in subsection C, the term discovered becomes pretty important, and that's what I've highlighted. It was based on that interview that was conducted without Garrity advisement that the conduct by Mr. Madsen was discovered. Based on that rule, when an interview is done outside of the scope of Garrity, and it discovers this type of behavior, that if you'll see the section heading on that rule, that no disciplinary action should take place. And so I would draw that to the attention. I would also draw to the attention of the council that post-investigator, Sergeant Zeman, the very first thing he did when he interviewed Mr. Madsen was advise him of Garrity and have him sign a Garrity waiver, which is exactly the way it should be done. And so Post, the investigation that was conducted by Post was done completely by the book and as it should be. And again, I believe that the internal affairs deputy in Cache County. It was just an instance of his first time doing it. We're not alleging that there was any sort of desire to deceive Mr. Mattson. It just would have been helpful if Mr. Mattson had understood. The second point I'd like to bring up, and recognizing that ignorance to a law or rule is not an excuse, but I think it's a mitigator in this situation. I highlighted in the Utah Code that I passed out 53-6-211, sub 1, sub F, engages in sexual conduct while on duty. This was codified in 2010, so it's a very recent codification where the legislature's distinctly called out engaging in sexual conduct while on duty. If you'll recall from the director's synopsis, the behavior in which Mr. Mattson engaged in, or the conduct that he engaged in, took place in the fall of 2011, so just about a year after this rule was codified. And Mr. Mattson honestly did not know what he was doing was in violation of the code and of the post rules. As a matter of fact, when it was brought to the sheriff's attention, the sheriff also did not know. He was unaware that engaging in sexual conduct was a violation. I think this is further recognized of how unaware deputies in Cache County were, that there were other deputies that engaged in exactly similar conduct that were not sanctioned at all by post. And in fact, Mr. Mattson's directly commanding officer engaged in sexual conduct in his patrol car in the fall of 2004, and in less than 2 years was then actually promoted to a sergeant. And that was, again, this is not a situation where we're trying to throw that sergeant under the bus, just to kind of give you the ability to see Mr. Mattson's frame of mind, that he honestly was not aware that this was a violation. I also think it's important to note that at the time that the conduct took place, Mr. Mattson was not on shift. He was on his way to shift. Now, we fully recognize and admit and see that the rule for on duty is if he's in his uniform and in his patrol car. But I do think that for mitigating circumstances, it's important to note he was not on shift. Many of the other cases, as I reviewed, the cases that the council's seen on sexual misconduct, many of them occurred while the deputy or officer was on shift. This was not the case with Mr. Mattson. I would also, as a mitigating circumstance, like to point out to the council that no criminal violation took place here. Mr. Mattson didn't violate any criminal laws. There are no allegations or no criminal actions pending against him. The activity that he engaged in was done with a consenting adult. It wasn't a situation where the fact that Mr. Mattson was a law enforcement officer, that wielded some sort of undue influence over his partner in this action. It was a situation where they were two consenting adults and engaged in something that was against the rules. And finally, I would like to point out that Mr. Mattson has had high-performance evaluations throughout his time with the Cache County Sheriff's Office. All of his evaluations came back at commendable or higher. This is a good deputy we're talking about, and one who loves his job. I think you can see that as he stood before you today, that he dearly wants to be a law enforcement officer again and is working towards being able to do that. He's already been contacted, as he talked about, by many other deputies, many of his colleagues in Cache County with the other departments, as well as with the sheriff's office, that are rooting for him, that are hoping to see him have a positive result from this. And he's also been contacted by a chief of one of the departments in Cache Valley, letting him know that once he gets his certification in order, to contact that chief to look into getting employment with that department. And as I've already emphasized, I want to point out again, these are not excuses for Mr. Mattson. Mr. Mattson stood before you and accepted responsibility for what he did. These are some mitigating circumstances that I think shed a great light on the action that he engaged in. He loves being a law enforcement officer, and that's what he wants to do with his life. And at this point in time, we would respectfully request the baseline sanction of 18 months suspension is what the council imposes on Mr. Mattson at this time. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, Mr. Erickson, I'm going to take a few exceptions with you on the Garrity issue. Certainly, I disagree with you that Garrity needs to be given every time a supervisor talks to an officer. I don't see how this went beyond the scope of an administrative interview. As a chief, I have a duty, if I have an officer engaging in this type of activity, to talk to them in an administrative interview. Doesn't require Garrity, because I have policy in place. I disagree with you that there was no violation of the law. I believe the adultery laws are still on the books in Utah, so that was a misstatement on your part. And as far as the not on duty, I think just about anybody would recognize a marked police car with a deputy sheriff or police officer who simply removes his uniform shirt and gun belt, stills wearing their ballistic vest, and then engages in sexual activity with the police car in close proximity is going to probably make the assumption that that officer is on duty. And I'm going to expect that officer driving my car on their way to work to respond to any law enforcement incident that may arise or that they observe, regardless if they are on the clock or not. So those are some concerns I have with your comments.
And if I could address those, Chairman, I appreciate that. Certainly I would agree wholeheartedly with you about the scope of Garrity. This was an administrative interview. What I was meaning to point out by that was that based on the protocol that POST imposes, and that, to my knowledge, and I don't pretend to know every internal affairs officer throughout the state, but I think that that's protocol that they advise officers when doing an internal affairs investigation of their Garrity rights. I agree with you that the interview that was conducted with Mr. Mattson was within the scope of an administrative interview because there wasn't a law broken. Although, as you correctly point out, there are some adultery laws on the book. I do think and hope that we all realize that those are not.
I understand that, but and because POST has a procedure to administer Garrity, that does not bind any other law enforcement agency in the state to do so during an administrative hearing.
Correct, so, and please, I hope that I did not mean to misspeak. My hope was to show the mitigation, not that we should remove any sanction from Mr. Mattson at this time. That was my hope, was to show there were some mitigating factors. As to the on duty, I believe that, Chairman, you were reading from the administrative law. The findings of fact there. Here today, we're not making any argument that he wasn't on duty. What I was trying to point out was that he was not on shift and that he was not aware of the on duty. Agree wholeheartedly that per the rule, he was on duty. He was in uniform. He was in his patrol car. Just that at that moment in time, his frame of mind was that he was not on shift. And so that was what I hoped to bring forward. And I apologize if I miscommunicated that today.
All right. Sheriff, I meant you had comments.
Yeah, notwithstanding what may or may not have happened during the administrative interview with Cache County, you have already stated that POST, when they interviewed, they did give the Garrity warning right up front. What the facts that we are looking at today and considering are all of the facts that were obtained by the POST investigation. So everything that we're looking at, according to you, and I just want to clarify that, was obtained properly in your mind. Is that correct?
Correct. Other than what I wish to emphasize was the discovered part. The misconduct by Mr. Mattson was discovered via the interview with the internal affairs officer at Cache County, where no Garrity was issued. However,
well, wait a minute. Let me stop right there. Not so, because what I'm saying is that the facts that we're looking at right here were all obtained by a POST investigator, POST Garrity.
Correct. But I guess what I'm trying to emphasize is that the POST investigator, he was made aware by Cache County, so he discovered the allegations of the offense via the internal affairs investigation in Cache County. That's how it was brought to POST's attention. But absolutely, and we point out, readily admit, that POST did a stand-up job with their investigation, Garrity waiver right off the bat.
Right, and those are the facts that we are looking at and that we are considering today. We are not considering any of the facts that were obtained during the Cache County interview at all. Okay. We are considering only the facts that were obtained by the POST investigators, which, according to you, were obtained properly.
Correct. And again, I think... And it's become apparent to me I've not communicated very well with you guys today, and I apologize for that. What I was trying to emphasize was that it's a mitigator because in Mr. Mattson's mindset, all these things were already before the investigator, already before. And so because Garrity had been waived, or not waived, Garrity hadn't been issued him, it may have had a different turn of events had he been issued Garrity at that level. But again, as was correctly pointed out by Chairman, that was not required by law, simply trying to point out as a mitigator.
Hey, Mr. Wallentine.
Assuming that I were to accept your derivative evidence theory, which I don't, but assuming that I did, you're asserting that the conduct would not have been known to Post but for an interview with an investigator in Cache County, which you assert was flawed because of the lack of a Garrity warning. Is that, am I understanding you correctly?
Just
a yes or no question.
I don't think we've asserted it was flawed. We've asserted that it was a mitigator.
All right, fine, a mitigator. But the findings that we have before us say that he was called in for an IA investigation. Something started this ball rolling.
Correct.
Now, do you have a transcript of the interview, or have you reviewed the interview with the Cache County IA investigator?
I have not seen that. We had the opportunity to speak with him through the ALJ hearing, and that was when it came up that no Garrity was issued.
Was there any evidence that there was a statement made to your client that he had to answer, that he was compelled to answer questions?
Yes, that came up. That came up in the administrative law hearing.
And did he at that point give any indication that he didn't want to answer questions?
He did not.
How did he get to the IA interview in the first place? If the conduct wasn't known?
To my knowledge, it was the allegation was taken to the IA officer beforehand.
So the allegation was there, so it's really not. If you just scratch out the fact that there was an interview at Cache County, that situation still ends up here at Post Counsel. That's right.
Correct. Again, we're looking at it as a mitigating factor here.
All right. Any further questions for Mr. Erickson? Okay, seeing none, thank you, Mr. Erickson.
Thank you.
I'll bring it back to Council for further Director?
Make a few points.
Sure.
I think Chief Wallentine has established the fact that the information came to us appropriately, but I just want to reiterate 536211-6, which instructs a chief or sheriff or administrative officer of a law enforcement agency. If they're aware of the allegations, shall investigate the conduct and the found to be in violation, and if found to be in violation, needs to report it to Post. That's pretty clear in the statute. Also, the baseline is 3 years for a category B, not a year and a half. Under on duty, the definition of on duty in our administrative law, I argue that it's not a mitigating circumstance if he was not on duty receiving compensation. It says that it lists a few, and then it says, or in a public place and is wearing a badge or a uniform authorized by a law enforcement agency, which readily identifies them as an officer. And if I could just read a couple of statements from the ALJ ruling itself. Mattson testified that he did not believe himself to be on duty because he had not yet reported for his shift. He further testified that he was unaware of the definition of on duty contained in the Utah Administrative Rule until he was informed of the rule when the Cache County Sheriff terminated his employment. Quite simply, this argument fails because ignorance of the rules is not a defense. There is no mental state component to a violation of 536211, so it is immaterial as to whether or not Mattson knew he was in violation of Post statute. Also, upon reading the definition of on duty contained in the administrative rule, it is clear the intent of the rule is to prohibit sexual activity by an individual who can be readily identified as a peace officer in a public place.
Is that all, Director?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Questions for Director Stevenson? Okay. Now I'll bring it back to the Council for a motion or further discussion.
I'll make the motion that we accept Post's recommendation.
Motion is second. Discussion on the motion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Next case involves Paul B. Schmidt, former with UDC, Salt Lake Airport. The charge is unlawful use of prescription medication of Category A. I'm recommending a 3-year suspension. This is signed under a waiver. Individual resigned 4/19 of 2013. On April 22, 2013, Paul Schmidt submitted an application to post to attend the law enforcement block of the academy. Schmidt indicated on his application he illegally used a narcotic analgesic in January of 2010. Post conducted a Garrity interview with Schmidt where he admitted to using his wife's prescription medication. The incident actually occurred in January of 2012 and not in 2010 as originally reported. Schmidt was employed with the Utah Department of Corrections at the time. However, has since resigned to obtain employment with another agency. We ultimately denied his application.
All right. Any questions for Director Stevenson?
And I apologize, I'm new, Scott. Did this person work for the Department of Corrections?
Yes.
At any time?
Okay. Yes.
So this is one of those that I assume I need to refuse.
Correct, Director.
I missed it when I read it. Yeah,
that's okay.
So.
All right.
Okay,
thank you.
All right. Any questions for Director Stevenson? Back to Council for discussion or motion.
Move to accept the recommendation.
Wait, sorry. I didn't think you were here. All right, Mr. Schmidt, would you like to say a few words?
Yes.
I apologize.
Please.
Sounds like mine's already made up, but I just want to be as clear as possible. I feel horrible about this. I do want to clarify that when I gave the date, when I was being interviewed for the airport, it was totally off the cuff. They asked me a question. So have you ever done this? And I said, well, yeah. And he says, well, it said in your application that you didn't. And I said, well, it should have said that I did. He said, well, do you remember when you did? And I said, a couple years ago, I think. And so then that was with the polygraph guy. And so he went through the whole polygraph with me. And that's what I gave as my answer. And then I got brought up again with the psychiatrist I had to meet with, and I gave him, the whole explanation, why I had done it and everything. And then I went and spoke with the lieutenant and discussed it with him and told him why I had done it. And out of 400 guys, they still hired me. And I was very, very, it was the happiest day of my life when I found out that I was going to work for them. And that's the only reason I resigned my job, was because I knew that I got hired by the airport. And then Sergeant Lucas called me and said, hey, this is on the application. We need to talk about this. I said, sure. And so I came in and met with her, and it was obvious that it was a big deal, that this is a much bigger deal than I realized. And I've been trying to be as honest as possible throughout this whole process. And on my way home, she called me and said, this is what I need you to do. I need you to get me every single fact you can find. I need you to get me medical records. I need you to get, what exactly it was, what the milligrams were, what the exact date was. And that's when my wife and I, we researched, and we realized, you know what, this was way more recent than you guesstimated. And we found the exact milligrams. It was after my wife had a miscarriage, and she had some leftover pain medications, and I used them. I was in pain, and I used them. And I've tried to teach my kids my whole life. You can't have selective integrity. There's integrity, and that's it. There's not selective integrity. And I've just been the biggest hypocrite in the world because... I didn't realize how important it was, how big of a deal it was at the time, but I did it, and like I said, it was the happiest day of my life when I found out that I was going to be an actual law enforcement officer. I have to admit, I wasn't excited to work at the prison. That was my first job. I started the academy just over 2 years ago to work at the prison because I needed to get out of construction. But everything progressed so fast. I got a job with APMP working for them, and then the airport opened up, and they actually hired me. I couldn't believe it. And I actually took a week off before I started the academy. That's when I resigned. And then I got this phone call, and this all happened. And I don't hold any grudges. I think Sergeant Lucas did a great job. And it's whatever happens, I've learned a very, very important lesson. I've taught myself, but I've been trying to teach my kids the most important lesson. You can't have selective integrity. You can't be perfect on one thing, and then if you're going to be in law enforcement, you got to follow the law to the T, because people are watching and people are going to find out, and it's going to weaken their belief in the law enforcement system if you don't have perfect integrity. And that's all I have to say. And Mr. Bolander, I don't know if this is the right way of doing this, but I don't have any. I'm just letting you know I'm okay with you asking me any questions that you want. I'm not going to hold you responsible for asking something you shouldn't ask me or anything.
Okay. I appreciate that, Mr. Spinn. Again, I apologize for not recognizing you being here. Okay. So, counsel, any questions? Mr. Wellington?
What is the, and this question actually is for staff, what takes us to a three-year recommendation? Help me understand where we get to a Category A on this.
Sir, the medication that you took with the Percocet, which comes up as a Schedule 2 drug, which enhances up to a Class A. So that's where, that was based on.
Surprised your perk sets too.
Yeah.
Take your word for it.
Any other questions? All right, Mr. Schmidt, thank you. Bring it back to the council for discussion. About Director Stevenson, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
I'm good, thank you, sir.
All right, thank you. Discussion or a motion, Mr. Wallentine?
Prior to a motion, see some substantial mitigation here in a couple of respects. We don't get the full picture, don't see what decision was made, don't see the decision process from the airport chief of police, who apparently knowing at least all, or at least the majority of the facts that we've heard here today, still made the decision to go ahead with hiring. Tells us, I think, something about the quality of other qualities of the applicant. This is, like many situations, one of those that no one would have known about had there not been a self-disclosure. I suppose there is an argument that there could have been a revelation after a polygraph, although I kind of doubt it. And although I don't dispute that a Percocet be a Schedule 2 drug, I don't equate the use of a Percocet for self-medicating, which is improper and is unlawful. It's certainly not tantamount to smoking marijuana, using cocaine, or even, if you will, using oxycodone or some drug that is not only a Schedule 2 but in the powerful end of the Schedule 2 range. So I would make a motion to reject the recommendation of the staff and impose my substitute suggestion is a 6-month suspension.
Okay, we need discussion with Director Stevenson.
If I could just point out, that recommendation would be outside the guidelines that have been approved by POST.
I
just
remind that.
The only question I have, I'm not sure if the disclosure took place as a self-disclosure or during the polygraph? Do we have that information?
Let's ask.
Yeah,
let's ask. You said he didn't answer any questions. Let's ask.
Now, Mr. Spent, then we'll hear from staff.
This was brought up before they give you a polygraph.
Right.
They ask you all the questions that they're going to go over with you. And he asked me that question, and there was a mistake on the application that had been turned in. And so I told him right then, well, yeah, I had done that. And so I guess that's, is that considered self-disclosure or?
Well, yes, because you're going to take a polygraph. Then at least that's my look on it.
What was the mistake on the application, just so I'm clear?
That, another big mistake that I made was I turned over the application to my wife because I knew that she had helped me with my application when I turned it, when I went to post the first time. And so I knew that she knew all the right answers, and I should have done everything myself. But when she filled out the application, or the question, I guess the wording was confusing to her. She thought it was something about illegal drugs. And so she answered, no, I'd never done that. And so when the, I didn't remember that she had filled out the application until the polygraph guy actually showed it. He said, look, you answered no for this. And he showed it to me, and I saw my wife's handwriting, and I was like, oh, crud. And I thought that was the end of my career right there, because I thought, okay, this, but then he went ahead and just kept asking me questions, and says, okay, we're still going to give you the polygraph, and I'm going to ask you about this, and so make sure that you're completely honest about it now. And so, evidently, I must have, he was okay with my answers.
Did you read the application prior to submitting?
I did not read the whole application. I knew it was an application, I knew it was very thick, and I was very lazy, and I turned it over to my wife.
Thank you. Great. Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Director Steve?
Oh, sure.
Just staff.
Oh, yeah. We'll turn the time over to Director Stevenson and staff.
We have, you have enough to say?
Yes. Did you have information on that?
No, I just thought you wanted me to address, so.
Okay. All right. Well, oh, yes.
I'd like to, I don't know if it'd be killed, it says substitute motion to Ken's motion.
Okay.
Would that be the right way?
Mm-hmm. I think it is, yes.
Ken's motion. If we drop back down from Category A to Category C, Director Stevens, if you can correct me, is the right, mm-hmm. We went to a falsifying an application, would that change the category parameters?
Yes.
Would that be something that we could do instead of the parameters post?
These guidelines are not binding. The council could come to any conclusion they deem fit.
I'm not standing. I'll withdraw that substitute motion.
Yeah, all right. So we're back to Mr. Wallentine's original motion. And we have a second. Any discussion?
Yeah, can I have discussion?
Yes, discussion.
Okay. I completely am sympathetic to what's going on here, and I understand what Chief Wallentine, where he's coming from with his motion, substitute motion. But abuse of prescription narcotics is one of the most insidious and difficult problems that we're dealing with in contemporary American society today. This is a major issue. You cannot ingest narcotics that have been prescribed to somebody else because you feel bad or you're sick. This is one of the big issues that we contend with here, and in the state of Utah is one of the bigger offenders regarding the prescription narcotic abuse. I don't know that I can go with 6 months, but I do think there are some mitigating circumstances here. I don't know. I'm just now talking, so I'm still trying to figure this out. I think there does need to be some sort of, there needs to be a consideration here, but I don't know that 6 months is that. I'm not really prepared to make a second substitute motion, so I guess I'm done talking. point of clarification, was there information to sustain the fact that the application was falsified, or are we, is that part of what we're looking at here or not?
Nope, we're looking at unlawful use of prescription medication.
So that can't be taken, that's not to be considered in this?
I believe you could make a substitute motion to change, since it has been entered in that, a mistake was made on the application.
And that would go, just to clarify, that would go to aggregating, mitigating circumstances to the count.
Okay.
Not, you can't change the count itself, but you look at it more as a mitigator or aggregator, depending on.
Any other discussion? Okay, seeing none, we have a motion and a second on the floor. All in favor?
Aye.
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 All opposed? Okay, it looks like the motion carried. Do you need a hand count?
I need a opposed.
Okay, all those opposed, raise your hand. We have three, four.
Four.
All in favor? Okay, motion carries.
Okay. Next case involves Kyle J. Smith, formerly with Salt Lake City PD. The offense category is falsifying a post-application, which is a Category C, recommending a 2-year suspension. This is signed under waiver, terminated from the Department 10-4 of 12. On September 9, 2012, Kyle Smith, a law enforcement officer, completed an application to attend the Salt Lake City Police Department's Basic Training Academy. Smith had also submitted two previous applications to attend a satellite academy. In all three applications, under the section asking about any involvement in the crime of unlawful sexual conduct, and the section asking about crimes of dishonesty, Smith marked no on the application. While in the Salt Lake Police Academy, after attending the ethics class presentation, Smith submitted an addendum to his post-application. Smith reported he solicited a prostitute on three separate occasions and had stolen $40 from his family's business. As a result of his disclosure, Post conducted a review of Smith's post-applications, and an investigation was opened. Post concluded Smith willfully falsified his post-application to obtain certification when he failed to disclose his solicitation of prostitution and the theft from his family's business.
Questions of Director Stevenson? So Mr. Smith or legal counsel for Mr. Oh, I'm sorry, Ken, did you have a question?
I do. Director, this case juxtaposed to the previous one, I think, addresses the discussion that we had last meeting and the meeting before with respect to the counsel seeing the entire packet. And I'm still not sure whether, and I get that there's some issues with that, Mr. Bolland. I'm still not sure where the comfortable median is there, but to me, this illustrates the necessity for staff giving us as broad a picture as possible. I think we just made a judgment. I certainly just made a judgment with respect to Mr. Schmidt that right now seems appropriate and fair to me. I set that next to Mr. Smith, and I don't know if Mr. Smith's here, but I got to tell you, I see a world of difference in the qualitative inaccuracy on an application in soliciting a prostitute three times. And maybe that's because I'm one of the few chiefs that still has anybody that enforces sexually oriented business and prostitution. I don't know, but it seems to me that the more information that we can get, the more we see whether really the underlying conduct is really within a category A or C. The last one I saw lower. This one, I got to tell you, I'm instantly thinking this is not a category C. So, Director, that's
my comment.
You've
got somebody behind you that wants to.
I'm not asking Mr. Chairman for any action at this point. I just think that it's illustrative of why some of us have asked for more information.
Fair.
Any other questions, Director? All right, Mr. Smith, would you like to say a few words, sir? Clint, would you step to the podium and provide your name for the record, please?
My name is
Kyle Smith. I'd like to start off by apologizing for everything. Yes, I did mark no on the two answers on the first three, or the three applications. I explained to Rex Dana, my post-investigator, that on the first one, I was not aware that soliciting a prostitute was unlawful sexual activity. I realize that's naive to not realize that, but when I was filling out that application, I believe that was more of rape and something more serious. And so, I admit that I did it. I'm not denying that. I feel horrible about it. I was unbelievably excited when I got the call to come interview with Chief Burbank. I traveled all the way from Southern Utah for every test. So, however, I was the one to disclose to Post and Salt Lake this information. And when I spoke with Rex Dana, he even told me that if I had not brought this up to them, that I would still be working for Salt Lake. There's no documentation. It was my word saying that I admitted that I did it. And so I just hope that you take that into consideration, that, I admit that I did it, but I told the truth about it. And because of that, I'm here before you guys. And so any questions, I will absolutely answer.
Sure.
So, Mr. Smith, you're going to stick with the testimony that you solicited prostitutes on several occasions and you did not know that was unlawful?
No, sir, I'm not saying that. The first time was before I filled out the first application, and that's my mark no, because at that time I didn't believe it to fall into that category for that question. Like I said, my mindset was unlawful sexual activity was rape, sodomy of a child, serious offenses. And so that is why I marked no. On the second one, I couldn't tell you my mindset. That was 3 years ago. And on this last application, I went through it, and it was, I filled this out twice before. It's all no. And once I took it to go turn it in, and I believe it was Investigator Zeman who gave the presentation, said to make sure you double-check these answers. I looked at it and realized that I had made a mistake and went up and told him, hey, there are these differences. I need to write an addendum. And so, like I said, I was the one that pointed this out to him. I'm not asking to be excused from it. I'm just saying that, because I wanted to tell the truth, if I wanted to lie to Post or to Salt Lake, I would have just handed it in. No questions, no nothing. I'm sorry.
One more question. What state is this solicitation in?
Utah. I do want to point out, just because I'm not sure if it makes a difference, but the third time there was no money involved. The escort, prostitute, whatever you want to call her, showed up and I told her, no. So there was no unlawful sexual conduct. There was no money exchanged.
Okay. Any other questions, Mr. Smith? Thank you, Mr. Smith. Director?
Nothing, Chair.
All right. Any questions for Director Smith or Director Stevenson? All right, back to the council for further discussion.
I have a question too about the process. So, Director, it's two suspension. That suspension means he cannot reapply
for 2 years.
Academy for 2 years.
Correct.
So he still have to be hired and then reapply, and your staff would disqualify him if the council accepts a recommendation. Would disqualify him for at least 2 years.
Correct.
Further discussion? Seeing none, we'll bring it to a vote or a motion.
Make a motion to accept the recommendation of POST.
Okay. We have a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?